Scott.
This is Pat.
Hey, stay tuned for this show. We're going to talk some about the elections and the financial markets.
What a week it was. We've also got Dr. O'Dean, who's specializes in investor psychology. He's a professor at UC Berkeley.
And we're going to take your call, 1-888-2-HANSON. Again, 1-888-2-HANSON. Stick around for Hanson McLean's Money Matters.
And now, nationally recognized financial experts Scott Hanson and Pat McLean of Hanson McLean Advisors. It's Money Matters.
Welcome to Hanson McLean's Money Matters. I'm Scott Hanson.
I'm Pat McLean. Thanks for joining us.
Glad you're with us, obviously. This financial program, and we're going to
talk about... Wow. what do you say?
Here's from our perspective, right? Obviously, we're going to talk some about the election, and we're not going to spend... But by the way, just a little warning, we'll spend a... few minutes at the beginning of the program,
and then we won't bring it up again. Yeah,
because
promise,
you get it
everywhere
else.
Tired of it. You're most of you are glad it's over, regardless of the decision.
But we're going to spend a little time just talking about it and how the financial markets reacted, and really what you can learn from that as an investor for your own portfolio.
Oh, and we'll get into like a little bit of the investor psychology, because we manage money for individual investors, and we have thousands of investors and families, and we have had certain groups of clients, both on the right and on the left, over the previous 3 and 4 weeks that have been just flipping out to this whole thing. The world is coming to an end based upon this decision.
Well, here's what was so interesting. So Tuesday night, election night, I actually went to the Sacramento Kings game. With a one, which was a miracle. So right there regardless of how you felt about the election, if you were a Kings fan, you were happy about it. So I went to the Sacramento Kings game. And as I'm there watching on my phone, I'm watching the election results come in. And at the same time, I'm watching the Dow futures, right? And as it looking more likely for a Trump win, we saw the futures drop 200 points, 400 points, 800 points.
670, 700.
We were down 4%.
In no time at all.
So as this is happening, we're thinking, wow. And you know, one of the things is, as a firm, we want to make sure that we communicate with our clients. We have several thousand clients that we want to make sure that we communicate with them. So we had actually started having some texts and emails around with some colleagues saying, hey, maybe we should do a video for our clients first thing in the morning.
Yeah, email chain saying, hey, should we get into the studio and... try to make sense of this.
So we're kind of getting that all lined up. And then went to bed after the Trump announcement, got up early in the morning and watched the Nikkei had a bad day, but the European market had recovered and suddenly things were already in positive territory. Then when the markets opened, we saw them just charge right ahead, and they ended up finishing, up 250 points plus or minus on that Wednesday. And so... we didn't do the video because there wasn't a lot of panic any longer. It just kind of swung to the other direction. And
the previous day, the market was up considerably. Wasn't it on Tuesday?
Yeah, we had, you know what's interesting?
Monday?
Pat,
was it?
We had, leading up to this, we had like 7 days. It was after the FBI came out and said that they found more emails, right? Then every day we had a downward day for the S&P 500.
And
we had
9 days in a row.
We had the worst streak we'd seen in...
Not the worst percentage loss,
no,
just the number of days
in
where
a row,
the market was...
Days in a row. And then when it came out that, they had read the 600,000 emails over the weekend or whatever it was. And then we saw the markets started heading back up. And then we saw just solid climb up through...
Yeah.
Just amazing.
But what it tells you is that it is absolutely impossible to predict short-term market volatility on political reasons. Absolutely impossible. It can't be done. That's what it taught you. First of all, because you couldn't call the election. I mean, most of the polls.
Well, I think it was a surprise to everybody.
Including the
right here. Wow, you know,
including the two people running for the office.
Surprise for both of them. Wow.
Like what?
But yeah, you can't predict these things.
And first of all, you couldn't predict well, maybe some people predicted Trump would take it, but the predictions that we had read previously is there might be some market jitters if Trump wins and Hillary Clinton loses, because Hillary Clinton, you pretty much know what to expect. And with Trump, no one really knew. But the market said exactly the opposite.
That's what. Well, at first they were saying exactly what you would expect. One would expect.
Yeah.
But then...
Yeah, and remember, the Dow futures aftermarket are thinly traded as well, so it's not like...
Yeah, but not that thinly. I mean, you know, and you realize every time you see a number, that's a trade. That is one... There is one that some investor made the trade at the worst time on the futures. Yes. Betting the market was... Someone said this is a buying opportunity, while someone else said this was a selling opportunity, which all... That happens every time you make a transaction. There's always someone on the other side who has a different view of the world than you have, which I think it's an always important thing to remember as well.
Yeah, yeah. Not only do you ask, why am I buying, but you ask, why are they selling?
But I think some, if you want to look at some things that you probably should be investing in right now, sign manufacturers, right? Right. Like the Trump White House, the neon lights there. You know, like Trump National Park. They're probably at the... Mount Rushmore, they're probably doing yet one more bust
right now.
Right? He's probably got them lined up now. So I didn't think about it. The Rock Chiselers.
That's a big field. That's a up and coming.
Just think of all the investment opportunities.
Oh, you kid. Well, we'll see. And oftentimes just we'll see. We'll see. But I got to tell you, I was really, Scott, impressed by both of their speeches when it was done. When Hillary conceded, the election, I thought it was gracious. I thought it was well done. I thought it was unifying. And I thought that Trump actually, with almost a presidential flair. Accepted it.
Anyway, but you know, if you've listened to this program, we've done this program for 20 some odd years. We don't like getting political because understand that everyone has different points of view, and we respect many different people and their points of view. And we don't think it's really germane to the financial planning that we do with our clients. So we try to stay apolitical. But when you've got something like this, we'd at least discuss it.
The program. Don't call in with a political question.
No, we're not going to take any.
But you can call in with a question at 888-2-HANSEN. That's 888-2-HANSEN. And you can call in with a question.
That's right. And now let's do the new view of retirement. Now, during this segment, we typically have had guests on. They'll talk about kind of a changing view of retirement, how boomers are approaching retirement a little bit differently. Today, we're taking a slightly different direction. Still deals with a lot of people in retirement. And we're going to talk to an expert on financial behavioral issues. And Professor Terrence O'Dean is I've been following some of his stuff. When he was back at UC Davis.
He was great. Oh, well, he still is great. He still is great.
He was great.
He's great.
Yeah, but he's a professor over at Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. And he's probably one of the leaders in behavioral finance research and one of the great thinkers, I think, out there today. So, Dr. O'Dean, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks very much. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, and you've written extensively on behavioral finance issues, and that's where how many people out there are there like you these days on behavioral finance? Because it's relatively new in the realm of financial matters.
Well, the study of it is
that's
relatively
what I mean. Yes,
new.
Yes, obviously the behavioral issues have been there since day one, but.
Yeah, I'd say there are lots of people doing research in behavioral economics and behavioral finance these days. It was a much thinner field 25 years ago when I started doing my dissertation work in this area, but there are a lot of people interested in it today.
All right, so and I actually think as financial advisors, one of the greatest values we add to people is keeping them from making mistakes. Is what it seems to be. Obviously, we do the planning, but then invariably some emotional issues come up, and people want to make decisions often at the wrong time. So, I guess one of the questions we've got with all the information that's available today, when we're in the information age for crying out loud, why is it that the average investor continues to make the same mistakes? You know, they buy when things are expensive, etc.
Sure. So, first of all, information doesn't really change emotions. And it doesn't change the biases we have in decision making. One of the biases is sometimes called availability or recency bias. And you think that what's happened lately is, or what you can easily remember happening, is how things are going to go in the future. So you see a stock going up and you think, oh, that's a stock that goes up. And there's a tendency, people mostly buy stocks that have been going up, and so let's talk about where information comes in. You'd say, okay, well, now that people have so much more financial information available, maybe that should keep them from making these mistakes. And I actually think that information can not only doesn't solve these sort of emotional decision-making problems, but it can exacerbate them. Too much information can actually lead investors to become overconfident, to think to themselves, oh, I've got all the same data that the experts have, therefore, you know, it's a level playing field. And that's probably not true. Let me give you an extreme example of how information doesn't always help. What if we had a roulette wheel and I told you everything anyone knew about that roulette wheel? I could tell you where the ball had landed the last 10,000 times the wheel was spun. I could tell you what factory the roulette wheel was made in, to what specifications. You'd know everything anyone knew about that roulette wheel, but you still wouldn't know the one thing that you wanted to know.
Yes. What happens next?
Yeah, where the ball's going to land. And, you know, the market's not as random as a roulette wheel, but from the point of view of a lot of investors, it basically is. And, you know, you can imagine a roulette wheel that has a bit of a bias, and you could get all that information and maybe hand it to, you know, a statistician and a computer scientist, and they'd come out and say, well, we still don't know where the ball's going to land, but we can get you a bit of an edge. And to some extent, that's sort of what happens at hedge funds and on Wall Street. You know, a lot of money and a lot of brain power is put into getting a little bit of an edge, and the value of that edge usually goes to the company that's managing money.
Yeah. So yeah, if you look at hedge fund returns, on average, they are not that great. And I think the ones who are making the money are the hedge fund managers.
Yeah, I'd say the hedge fund returns tend to be much better for the managers.
Yes, they're not hedging anything. That's what.
So yeah. So this. When we have all this information available, it also creates, I believe, confirmation bias, which is people actually seek out just that information that confirms their
absolutely their decision making. A lot of biases. I don't know if I'm allowed to pitch someone else's book, but
yeah, fire away.
Do you guys? Anyone who wants to read a really good, albeit it's a long but very readable book, that's interested in behavioral science, behavioral finance, should read Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow. And Kahneman and his research partner, Amos Tversky, developed this field of judgment decision making, which led to behavioral economics and behavioral finance. But it talks about a lot of the biases we have, and one of the biases is confirmation bias. Once we make up our mind, we go around looking for reasons why we're right. And what you should really be looking for is reasons why you're wrong.
So basic statistics 101, test the null hypothesis, correct?
Yeah. No, I mean, this happens in research. I see this in, you know, the research that I do, my colleagues do. I have to fight the urge, once I've come up with an idea, fight the urge to just look for confirming evidence and just do what's harder but more important, which is look for reasons why you're wrong. And if you look really hard for reasons why you're wrong and you can't find any, it's possible you're right.
So one of the things
guaranteed.
One of the first things you state in this program is that information doesn't change emotions.
Yeah.
Why is that? And how do I change my emotions then? If I've got this urge to, I think I'm going to double my money, and I see this great stock or this real estate opportunity, whatever the case may be, right? That's what happens with investors all the time.
How do I keep the fear and greed in check? Another way.
And I think you do it. You know, people can go about this differently, but basically stepping back in times when, you know, you're not feeling emotional and making decisions about your investment strategy, your investment behavior. And, you know, for most people, this is going to be, for most people should just be buying low-cost, well-diversified mutual funds. Very, you know, index funds for many people are certainly the way to go. Fees are really important, and yet people focus on returns. There's a great study done by friends of mine who gave staff at Harvard and MBAs at Wharton the opportunity to invest in four different index funds, all S&P 500 index funds. All of these funds are going to earn the same basic return. And the funds differed in the fees they charged and in the historical performance. And the historical performance was just
the
driven
fees.
By when by when the fund had been founded.
Oh, got it.
Right?
Got it. Okay, and, so what happened?
And the vast majority of investors, you know, the tendency was to buy the fund, to say, I'd like to invest in the fund with the highest historical return. And what you should be investing in, these are S&P 500 index funds.
They're
the one
same
with the lowest
thing.
Fee.
They're identical funds. The lowest fee is the only thing that's going to make a difference there.
Yeah. So people pay a lot of attention to return. They tend to ignore fees. A smart investor says to himself, fees matter. Fees are for sure. This applies to, you know, buying mutual funds. This applies to financial advice. I think people really benefit from advice. I agree with you completely that the real value added for advisors is more often than not that they help people from hurting themselves. You know, they keep people from making mistakes. But even there, you know, you got to ask yourself, what's the right price?
Financial advisors should.
I think this tendency is happening that fees are starting to come down a little bit.
As they should.
But I just find it interesting. So I've been in this industry 25 years. And so watching the tech bubble in the 90s and, you look at some of these companies at the time, I didn't make any sense to me. I was like, it was interesting, Terrence, because someone would call and say, well, I'm thinking about buying this particular stock. What do you think? And I'd go, like, here's why I think it's a piece of garbage. And then 2 months later, they'd call back and they'd say, you know, I shouldn't have listened to you last time because it was at $60 then. Now it's at $80. Please put an order in for me, right? And so, and then, of course, we saw the tech bubble blow apart. And then people at the bottom of the market, they want to get out because things are bad and it's only going to get worse. And then we saw the real estate cycle. And I just was always kind of fascinated. I said, this is the time when any of us we have information available to us at our fingertips. So the average person can actually do some sort of research if they want.
Greater than any time in history.
And with some of the biggest bubbles that we've had in the last century.
Yeah, well, so as you say, people can do research, but take a look at the 90s. You had a new technology, and part of the problem was it was hard to value. Now, it wasn't impossible to value, but it was difficult to do valuations. People got excited, and the prices started going up. And, you know, you can harken back to tulip mania. You've got an asset, and people are excited about it, and the prices are going up, and it's hard to make a fundamental valuation. And now people are just focusing on, just like the client who wanted to buy it, and then it went up, and he says, well, now I'm buying it for sure, as opposed to saying, maybe it's overpriced now.
Yeah.
And you get this feedback loop that is self-fulfilling for a while, but obviously not forever, where people see the price going up, they buy it, the buying drives the price up, and it goes up until the bubble runs out of steam or gets burst or however you want to put it. But basically when people stop buying, and those things came down really fast.
Yeah, you're speaking of the tulip craze back in the 1600s and Holland.
So I guess this is leads to my question. So when I talk with clients, I actually talk about the three fees associated with a client within a portfolio, the three costs. And the first cost is if you use an advisor like myself, the first cost is the internal cost of whatever the investments are. The second cost is what we charge for our advice. And the third cost is the cost of risk, which is the hardest thing to quantify. So most people never try to quantify risk. Most advisors don't try to quantify risk. But the reality is that's the most expensive cost that you will have in your portfolio. How is the research going forward in helping people quantify risk? Are you spending time on that?
I have been working with some people more on trying to understand both how you evaluate differences in people, in investors, sort of the riskiness of their decision making. And here's what I mean. If you get most people who have similar economic circumstances should probably hold similar portfolios. If you have two, 40-year-old English teachers who are the same gender, married or not married, with no great differences in the inheritances they're going to get and stuff.
You mean they should, if they don't...
Same wealth, same income. They should be holding somewhat similar portfolios. The exception comes, and I would say mostly, that's how you should be determining people's or advising people is based on their circumstances. But the exception is, what if one of those teachers is likely to panic if the market drops 30%?
That's right. Yep.
Because sooner or later, the market is going to drop 30%. You can pretty much guarantee
of
that,
course.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And when it drops 30%, there's not going to be someone standing there who says, 30%, it's not going any further. It's going to be like it's down 30% and you don't know what's happening next.
And there'll be someone on the TV saying how that's going to go to zero. So,
that's exactly it. There's going to be someone on the TV saying this is the buying opportunity of a decade and someone else saying it's going flat. It's going down. This is it. This is the end. And so the reason, so what I'm interested in is what can we do to sort of predict who is in danger of panicking? And then for that person, you either want to put them in a lower risk portfolio or you want to have a plan in place. Like if the person has a financial advisor, this should be one of the advisees that gets the first call.
Got it.
That says, Mabel, the market's down a lot this morning. You probably know that. And we've talked about this a lot. And let's stick with our plan.
Well, it's interesting, Terrence. These are the type of things that we really try to understand with the clients we work with. And part is we want to find out how did you react during other periods of time?
I read the blogs about our radio show about people commenting about our advice. And they'll say, well, this person should be invested fully because they're 45. But when we ask the question, what'd you do last time? And they get bailed out of the market. They should not be in the market, maybe, regardless of their age or their net worth, right?
Yes, I agree. Someone else just like them maybe should be 90% in.
That's right.
But if they, and that doesn't mean, I think everyone can probably, most of us can tolerate a bad night's sleep or two. I lost a few nights' sleep in 2009, and I wasn't worrying about my own money. I was worrying about the country.
We
lost some sleep.
We were worried about credit freezing up and then food on grocery shelves.
I used to tell people, if you weren't worried during that time, then you were just ignorant of what was happening because there was very reason to worry. There's no question.
Right. So there's a difference between saying, this would cause me some worry and I'm going to liquidate.
Do you not think there's some tools out there today that are helping? There's been some improvement in the last 10, 20 years?
What sort of things do you think help people? I'm very curious.
Like Riskalyze, there's some companies out there. Yeah.
Or Pocket Risk that are trying to quantify this risk. So Riskalyze is one that has actually done a fairly good job. Yeah. And the other one is Pocket Risk. And they're relatively small companies that are just coming online in financial services, which are risk quantification tools.
Yeah. Well, this is a hard thing. I've been talking with different groups of people who are interested in just that question. And one of the hard things is doing the right sort of research, like getting the data, ideally, but this is very hard and time consuming. Ideally, you would ask a bunch of questions of a bunch of investors, and then you would get a crash a few months later.
Yep.
And you'd be able to say which people panicked and which didn't, and which of my questions were predictive of who would panic.
Yeah, you needed a longitudinal study over a market cycle.
Yeah.
Exactly. And you have to know stuff. You got to say, okay, what are reasonable questions that might be diagnostic of people's behavior in this situation? And then you want to observe. It's similar to what you're saying is you want to identify that. You want to know what are the characteristics of someone who panicked. And you're talking about one of the characteristics of someone who's likely to panic is they've panicked in the past. But what we'd really like to do is identify people in advance and say, this person's at risk.
Yeah.
And then there are various ways of dealing with that risk so that, because, you know, people who did go to cash in 2008, 2009, many of them are going to have to work more years to retirement than
Absolutely.
They would have otherwise. And that's, you know, that's unfortunate.
Well, Dr. O'Dean, certainly appreciate you taking the time. Thanks for being part of Hanson McLean's Money Matters.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Hey, we're going to take a head straight to take a break. Stick around for more Hanson McLean's Money Matters.
Helping you take the worry out of your retirement. It's back to Hanson McLean's Money Matters.
Welcome back to Hanson McLean's Money Matters. Scott Hanson.
Pat McLean, thanks for joining us again for the second half of the show.
That's right. Glad you're part of it. A couple things.
We're going to take your calls in a couple minutes.
Yeah. And if you want to join the show, like to be part of Hanson McLean, it's pretty simple. 1-888-2-HANSON is the number to be part of the program. It's 1-888-2-HANSON. What is it numerically? I don't know what it is numerically. It's something numerically, but it's 1-888-242. Look at, she's trying to do signs. 6766.
So 242-6766.
I get behind the booth. Great. Chris and John both doing hand signals so we can see what the numbers. But 1-888-2-HANSON to get, but figure that out as well. But anyway, we'd love to hear from you regarding something that's going on in your world. Retirement savings. What was the study I was just looking at? In 1980, roughly 80% of Americans had a pension. Those heading into retirement, 1980.
A defined benefit pension.
Yes, a monthly pension. Right? So 1980, this is a long time ago, but back then.
Wasn't that long ago.
Well, how old were you in 1980?
36.
I was a freshman in high school in 1980.
I was 17. So that would have made me...
Didn't even think about it.
The seventh grade?
Didn't really think about retirement. But fact is...
That's 80, a joke.
80% of workers who moved into retirement had a pension. Today, 25%, just under 25%. And I'd bet the majority of those are government employees that have pensions.
Yep. Yes.
So it's all being replaced with 401ks. Matter of fact, it was interesting. I was at the gym this morning talking to someone who's in law enforcement. And we were talking about just kind of what's been happening with police officers and... And I said something about, well, I couldn't imagine how it's probably pretty hard to attract people into the profession these days.
Very difficult.
And he said, yeah, once we did away with the pension and moved to a 401k. And I thought, I don't really think when most people 22 years old think about going to law enforcement, they're doing it so they can get a pension. The fact is, no companies are offering pensions. So it's not like you need to offer those to compete. And I'm not, but today, most people don't have a pension. So what do you do if you're going into retirement without a pension?
How do you handle that, right? So how do you take your dollars and turn them into a stream of income that acts like a pension?
So first of all, you're going to need to have some retirement savings, right? And if you don't have any retirement savings, you're probably not going to retire. But let's assume that you've prepared, you've put money aside, you've got money set aside for retirement. I mean, ideally, you've got money in your 401k, maybe in a Roth IRA, you've got some money on the after side. But what we found is that most people, it works best if they set up a monthly allotment that gets deposited in their checkbook, just like a paycheck used to. So although they don't have a monthly pension, you can structure money from a 401k or money from let's say you have a brokerage account with some different mutual funds, you can structure it so that money gets deposited into your checking account each month. And what we found is for most people at retirement stage, it makes life a lot easier if can budget off a monthly check. Most of us, that's how we live, right? It's
monthly.
Yeah, money coming in on a monthly basis. So If you don't have a pension, if you're like the 75% of Americans heading into retirement without any sort of monthly pension, talk to your advisor about having some sort of a monthly income established.
And it goes in automatically. And if it's coming from an IRA, most of the time you're going to want to withhold state and federal taxes that are applicable to your geography.
Yeah. And the other day I had a client that was in, and they showed me they were still paying quarterly taxes. And they wanted to increase their tax withholdings on their IRAs. And I said, well, we're already at 25% federal and 6% state. I said, what else is going on here? Well, there was a pension, a small pension. She was one of them that had to have a pension and Social Security and had no taxes withheld.
That's easy enough to do.
But sometimes when people say, how much taxes should we withhold? Look, it all depends on your other income.
Yeah, all the income coming in and where it's coming from. And rather than pay quarterlies, most of the time, people that are, we see it often where retirees will be paying quarterly taxes. You don't need to pay quarterly taxes in most situations. You just need to increase your withholdings either from Social Security, pensions, or your IRA.
Unless you have a lot of other
income.
Dividends.
Most retirees.
For most retirees, you don't need to pay quarterlies. I would agree with that. So, hey, if you want to be part of the program or take a call here to join Hanson McLean, it's 1-888-2-HANSON. Again, that's 1-888-2-HANSON. That would get you on the program. And let's talk with Jim in Sacramento. Jim, you're with Hanson McLean.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. How are you?
Wonderful.
Great. Great. Well, my question was, I'm in kind of a good position that I make a pretty good income. I've got about 4 years left to work. And apparently I make too much to have a Roth IRA. And I've heard that there are still ways of getting around that. Kind of you make three rights to make a left turn and you can do a Roth. Is that correct?
There we go. So you can own a Roth, but your income disallows you from contributing to a Roth.
What's the point of having a Roth if you can't?
Well, if you already, he said, I can't have a Roth.
Okay.
You can own a Roth.
There were benefits to having that, yeah, but my income is such that I make too much, I can't do it.
So you can no longer contribute to a Roth.
What you can contribute to, you are able to contribute to what's called a non-deductible IRA. I'm assuming you're over age 50, is that correct?
That is correct.
Otherwise, you'd be retiring awfully young, but okay. So you can contribute $6,500 to a non-deductible IRA, and you're thinking, why would I want to do that?
For both you and your spouse.
Although there's spousal limitations, if your income's above 187 or so, you can't contribute to a spousal.
Yeah,
unless
so we got that problem too.
Is your spouse work outside? Does your spouse work for a living?
Yes, she does.
Okay, then you both could contribute to a non-deductible IRA. Of course, that doesn't solve your problem. You think, what's the point? I don't want to have more money in an IRA if I don't get a tax deduction. But do you have other IRAs? Or just 401ks?
A 401, you know, I do have other IRAs, 401k, I have excess benefit.
So let's step back for a second. How much do you have in other IRAs, which are deductible IRAs, ones you took a deduction on? How much money is in that? Either you rolled over a 401k to get it there, or you made non-deductible IRA. You made deductible IRA.
About $500,000.
Okay.
And have you ever done non-deductible IRAs?
No.
Okay. So this $500,000 is all going to be taxable one day.
And right. Of this, tell us about your 401k that you have now. Are you self-employed or do you work for someone?
No, I work for someone. And at age 59 and a half, I was told I could take some out and not be penalized and roll it into other areas.
That's
and
right.
Have other advisors. So I've done that. So I still have about $700,000 in the work.
So we're going to tell you how you can take advantage of. And does your wife have IRAs outside of her retirement plan?
Yes, she does.
Okay. So we're going to tell you how to take advantage
and
of
whether or not it makes sense. We don't know.
And then we don't know. You're going to have to make up that. But we'll tell you how to do it, and then you decide whether you want to go through the hassle or not.
So if you made a non-deductible IRA contribution today, we finish the conversation now. You say, oh, great, I got the advice. You made a non-deductible IRA contribution and then converted it to a Roth. What would happen is for tax reasons, the IRS says, wait a minute, we can't just look at one IRA. We have to look at all your IRAs. And because you got $500,000 in IRAs, the vast majority of this conversion, we're going to pretend like it's coming from those other accounts, and only a small amount is going to come from that non-deductible. So the vast majority of it's going to be taxable. So that's not going to work. What you can do, not maybe whether or not it makes sense, I don't know. If you transferred all of your IRAs back into your company's 401k and your spouse did the same, now you no longer own IRAs. Yes, you own 401ks. You might have some other type of pension plans, but you no longer have any IRAs. Now, if you have no IRAs and you make a non-deductible contribution into an IRA, and once you can, you're for tax reasons, your cost basis, so to speak, is whatever your contributions were, $6,500. So when you convert that Roth, like non-deductible IRA into a Roth IRA, your taxable amount is going to be zero, and that's how you can get.
And the reason you couldn't.
So at the end
of
the day, you've got $6,500 into a Roth IRA, just like you would have been able to had you not had your income.
And the reason you have to move your IRA back to the 401k is because if you didn't do that, when you do the conversion from the IRA to Roth IRA,
pro rata,
they do a pro rata on it. So now, in saying all that, if that isn't significantly confusing, I don't know what is.
No, that's pretty well confusing. That leads me to my next question.
Okay.
So if a guy has done everything that he can, invested wisely, best thing I did was get married this last summer, and so we're kind of in the same boat. We make a lot of money. What is one thing that I could do? House is paid off. We're zero debt. What's one thing that I could really do, maybe besides this non-deductible IRA, that would be a smart and wise decision?
As far as saving more?
Well, yeah, we're saving like crazy, but I mean, I'm worried if stock market takes a hit and we're doomed, I'm told.
How much saving do you have outside of your four? What do you mean you're doomed?
Well, I say that the day you retire, if the market's down, you lose just so much money. There's no way to get out of that.
What percentage of all your assets are in stocks?
Probably 60-75%. Okay. I would imagine.
So here's how I would look at doing this. The best thing you could probably do is to buy tax efficient, inexpensive index or ETF funds outside.
Yes.
And lower your equity exposure inside.
I'd say a mutual fund, just so you can contribute to add to it.
Yeah, so it's easy on an easy base. So let's say you buy the total market, tax efficient, low cost outside. You take after tax dollars and you put it in there, and you say, "Well, I don't want any more equity exposure." Lower your equity exposure inside your 401k and your IRAs so that you actually remain at the same place. That is going to get you as a tax efficient as possible. I agree with you. I wouldn't go through the hassle of moving that 401k IRA back to the 401k to make the $6,500 contribution.
It's not worth it.
It's just too much of a hassle for very little benefit.
Right.
And you've only got 4 years to do it, because you said you're only going to work for another 4 years. That's what I would do. So I wouldn't increase my equity exposure overall. I would just use tax efficient index funds outside the 401k or IRA to do it and lower the equity exposure inside.
All right. Well, provided I can read these notes I've scratched down, that's what I'll do.
All right, Jim. You can always listen to a podcast of this program, but subscribe to our podcast. Yeah. And I'll do that. I think we send you a copy of this anyway.
Do we send them something?
Do we send our listeners a copy, a link of the program? Yeah, we'll send it to you.
Nice. Okay, throw those notes out the window.
Thanks, Jim.
Great. Thanks very much, guys.
Thanks. You know what, Pat? You know what I think gets overlooked sometimes is if somebody owns an index fund, let's say Jim, who we just talked to, owned an index fund. Let's assume that he contributed to it over the next 4 years. Let's assume, just for a second, that someone had amassed $100,000.
I know where you're going.
Right? And let's assume that he doesn't touch these dollars for a while and it grows and it's now worth $200,000.
Okay.
And he says, I'd like some income off this. First, one option is to sell a portion and pay capital gain tax.
Okay.
Which is a favorable. Matter of fact, if you sell it, he can identify which shares to sell and have the ones that are most tax favorable.
Sell those first.
Only half, essentially, if he had half the money would be subject to capital gains, half isn't because of the return of his basis.
The other thing you could do is
borrow against that.
Or don't reinvest dividends and capital gains in it. Because there's going to be some dividends and capital gains that come off an index anyway. And
after
you just stop that Or you could borrow against it.
You could borrow against it at the time first person passes away. It gets a stepped up basis, and essentially the taxes are forgiven. That kind of route is not maybe not as good as a Roth, but it's not that far.
It's not that bad. And it would dependent upon the age of the participant as to when you should borrow. But the easiest thing to do is just stop dividends and capital gains reinvestments, have those come to you, and then the second thing would be to borrow against. But it's not that far off from a Roth.
But I see people selling life insurance policies.
Oh, gosh. Now go on this.
I'm going to just for a second because...
this stuff, bank on yourself.
I talked to someone yesterday. Someone I know from the gym approached me.
Do you know any other people than people that go to the gym? Every story has someone that goes to the gym.
People I run with.
Okay.
Or cycle with.
Okay.
Or mountain bike with. How about
all right.
Other the gym.
Other skinny
other
people.
Than that.
Other really skinny in shape people. Okay. Well, the people I know at JJ North's buffet.
This person had a bunch of money in the life insurance policy. They were actually sold because it said it's going to be helpful for your kid getting school, getting money for education. So they took the retirement savings and threw it all in a big life insurance policy. It's terrible. But oftentimes people pitch life insurance. They say the tax benefits is great. They say, well, here's why you should invest in a big life insurance policy, because you can borrow on yourself. You don't have to pay the taxes. And once you die, they said, look, you put in the money. It grows. When you want to have some income, you just take a loan against it. No big deal. And you borrow against your own money, bank on yourself, right? I think that's the whole concept of that program. And then when you die, it's tax-free. So all that gain's forgiven. Look, you could do the same thing with a tax-efficient mutual fund. You buy the S&P 500 index fund. You can
a
let
lot
it grow.
Less expensive.
You can let it grow.
It gets a
you
tax.
You borrow against it.
Step up a basis at death.
Yeah, your heirs receive
and they
it
say, well, maybe they change the tax rules. That's
maybe
what
they do for life insurance,
maybe
too.
They do for life insurance as well. Maybe they do for both.
Anyway, I always cringe when there's life insurance stuff. So,
except for inexpensive, low-cost term insurance where you need it, where you actually have a need insurance.
Yes, life insurance. I love life insurance.
Well, I think that's pretty strong, and I think that's pretty...
All right. Well, I own life insurance, and anyone who has a dependent children needs life insurance
there
as well.
There we go.
Anyway, we are going to move now to real advice. During this segment, we like to talk with an advisor of Hanson McLane. Here's some sort of story about an individual or a couple or family that we've worked with, helped them through some sort of problem. And our objective here is for you to insert your own situation. Well, the fact is we have enough of these on, and everyone, you're going to have some, there's going to be some similarities at some point in time. You're going to think, that worked for them. Here's my situation. Maybe something like this will work for me as well.
You're going to be able to relate to it.
And so we talk with one of our advisors. Now, we'll bring up a situation of someone we worked with. Your results may be vastly different than what these
they
people
may
are.
Be better or worse. We don't know. Because we can't tell you they're going to be better. That would be considered a
promissory.
And we can't do that.
So we've got Lauren Williams. Lauren is a certified financial planner, a chartered retirement planning counselor. She's also CFP instructor of the UC Davis Extension Program. Been part of Hanson McLane for a number of years and been working for more than a decade in the field, but she works out of our Roseville office primarily and the Sacramento office as well. So, Lauren, thanks for being part of Hanson McLane.
Thanks for having me.
Glad you are with us today. And how you're at the UC Davis Extension Program for the CFP. How often do you teach a course out there?
I'm teaching the course out there every March through June once a year, and then I have another instructor who teaches it during the fall. Yes.
And what area of emphasis do you there's?
I'm actually teaching the very first course in the program, so what I cover is every part of financial planning.
So it's
from
the intro?
Insurance, investments, estate planning, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
So Lauren is a big proponent in seeing people become certified financial planners. And spends a portion of her life just helping people into the profession because she thinks it'll help people, which we believe as well.
Yeah.
So tell us about some people that you met with recently and what was their situation and all that.
Well, I met with a husband and wife, and they actually called out to us because they were having some concerns with advice that was given to them by a broker that they had worked with for a number of years. These two individuals are 57 years old, public service and communications for over 30 years each, and they actually do, they're part of the 25%. They have a pension, two of them, in fact.
Oh.
So they have pretty good income, actually. They're replacing or they're about to replace their income in retirement based on the pensions. They are both eligible for Social Security down the line. And they've actually done a fairly good job saving, or I would say a very good job. They have $1.5 million in assets. Some are taxable, some are pre-tax, some are Roth, and some are in after-tax. The advice that they had been given them that led them to coming to visit with us was that they should get a third annuity without really understanding why they had the first two to begin with. And with this third annuity, the
is one a teacher? Is one a teacher and had one for the school district or something? Why do they have annuities anyway?
You know, I don't really know why they would have annuities at this point in time.
Oh,
I
right.
know one of them, risk tolerance wise, could have potentially qualified for an annuity, but based off of income needs, overall risk tolerance, and financial goals, there isn't really a need for an annuity in this situation.
So
I think that's really what they started feeling.
So someone pitched the same person the third annuity, right? And then all of a sudden they're like, whoa. Tenna went up. What's going on here? So they come and see you or us.
So when they're in
the
my
firm.
Office, they come in with, you know, is this really in my best interest? That's what they said to me. And they were a little bit concerned because they never really knew what kind of fees they were paying. And the fees, you know, as I looked through the statements, I could tell they clearly lacked transparency. One of the biggest problems, though, I think, was the level of understanding that they had hoped to achieve by working with their previous broker was not being obtained. And the broker wasn't able to provide the broad financial planning advice, like taxes and estate planning stuff, covering some of that stuff with them. So they were getting referred out all the time, paying additional fees to the tax planner for helping answer simple tax questions. And to be honest, it really came down to a trust issue. When you lose that trust in your financial professional, that's when they have to go looking elsewhere.
Well, when your financial professional is selling you expensive products that have high commissions onto the third one, that's where the trust was lost.
Right, exactly.
And I assume it wasn't able to actually explain to them why they needed it.
No, and I think that's the question they were ultimately hoping to answer, is why do we need another annuity?
And they decided they didn't need one.
Right, absolutely. After we sat down, we did a couple different things in the office. We went through an income analysis, which was looking at the pension figures, Social Security figures, and the amount of money that could come off the assets. We also analyzed the portfolio, which was filled with high-cost mutual funds that were high-risk and actually quite low return over the last 5 years. And then we went into basic tax consequences. You know, we're 57 years old. We're separating from service. If I leave my 401k on the plan, you can take penalty-free distributions. If I advise somebody to move it off plan, I'm losing the opportunity for them to take the penalty-free distribution.
Is that what was being recommended to them?
Yeah, they were 57 years old. Go ahead and move this money off plan. Get an annuity, which still locks you in until 59 and a half.
So for the rest of the listeners, this is key here. If you're over age 55 and you separate from service and you can take money out of your 401k or retirement plan without penalty. You don't have to wait till you're age 59 and a half. So if you're over age 55 in the year in which you separate from service, you can get it, that money without penalty. 10% federal in the state of California, 2.5% tax penalty. If you move it to an IRA and then you try to take the money out of the IRA on a lump sum without turning it into a stream of income, you have a penalty. So it may make sense, and oftentimes does make sense, for someone to leave all if if not all, some of their 401k dollars at the previous employer when they separate from service. Yeah. All right, continue, Lauren, please.
What was the final? We have a couple minutes here. So, what was the final outcome, and what else might be unique here?
So, whenever we went through the 7 personal decision points and hidden levers, we determined, you know, they really did not need that third annuity, and we really needed to be more aware of the tax consequences of the decisions that were being made. So we ended up leaving the 401k on platform, and we'll continue to do that until they're 59 and a half and distributions can be taken without penalty. The rest of the money we went through did annuity analysis, and we'll be helping them service those till they're out of surrender. And if it is more beneficial to the client to be in the policy, then they will stay in. And if it is more beneficial to be out, then they will get out.
And Have you had a lot of experience in seeing people with annuities pitched and whatnot?
You know, it's interesting because I was just thinking about that. I've been seeing a lot more in the last few weeks, and I see this pattern every single time the market starts dipping down. I hear a lot more about annuities being pitched, but it is a really frequent thing outside of the downturns in the market as well.
And you started your career, weren't you with a big bank or brokerage firm or one of those?
I was a broker dealer bought out by a big bank.
And you saw how they would sometimes maybe encourage the sale of these products.
Well, they taught you how to align all of the client's annuities into a spreadsheet and sort them by surrender date. So surrender So where the client thought, "Oh, the annuity is now out of surrender."
We get those calls on the radio, and the people think we're out of time. They think their annuity is matured. I'm like, what are you talking about? And a lot of times, those old annuities are better than what's being sold today, anyway. So
appreciate you on the show, and appreciate you working with us at Hanson McLean Lauren.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Lauren. And I think you know what we heard in Wells Fargo the last few weeks. They're not the only bank that has been doing those things.
And
not here to necessarily knock Wells Fargo, but
it's
news speaks for itself on this.
You just want a fiduciary to manage your money.
Yeah. So anyway, we are running out of time here. We come to you each week during this time in this radio program. And of course, if you'd like a podcast of our show, you can always get a podcast at go to iTunes, search Hanson McLean, and sign up there. And you could also rate us, which we'd appreciate at Hanson McLean. And anyway, moneymatters.com's got a lot of great information. Go there and we'll see you next week. This has been Hanson McLean.
This program has been brought to you by Hanson McLean Advisors. Any ideas presented during this program are not intended to provide specific financial advice, and you should consult your own financial advisor or conduct your own due diligence.